Hi.
Hi. So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode number 98. Other Words for Home by Jasmine Warga.
I think all of my books, but particularly Other Words for Home, I'm always trying to encourage deeper empathy, right? I hope what they take from the book is this idea of how can I really think a little bit more deeply about what somebody else might be going through, and also how I can make my community that I live in feel welcoming to all different types of people. And also thinking about gratitude. Like, I think so many of us, and I'm guilty of this, forget how lucky we are to live somewhere that is very safe and very secure. And we aren't constantly worried about a war breaking out, right? Or where we're going to go. And what does that mean? What does our home mean to us? And just really encouraging sort of more radical kindness. I think that kindness, the more active we can make kindness, right, going out of our way to be welcoming, is something that I hope readers will take from the book.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we will take a thorough look at one piece of literature that we've both read and determine whether it is required reading. Here I am, again, leading a young adult novel, and we are transported back in time. And yet, this novel is also relevant because I saw Syria on the news recently. So, here we are, timeless things that we are talking about, but also trying to bring in some different representation that I think we've not had yet. And along for the ride to discuss some tough topics is my good friend, Tom Panarese.
Hello, how are you?
Oh, we're making it. We're making it. We're nearly there. As of this recording, we're nearly there to a nice little break. And yeah, I'm hoping for some snow this winter.
Me too.
Which I wonder, well, I think Jude enjoyed kind of the different aspects of the seasons that she got in Ohio.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that she appreciated snow even though it was cold.
Yes,
but
we just get cold sometimes. We don't even get snow sometimes down here in Charlottesville.
Yeah, I know some people feel like there's no purpose to it being super freezing unless it's snowing. Like, then snow is like, okay, this is the reason why it's cold.
So yes.
But I'm good with cold weather, but I would love snow to go along with it. Well, yes, we are doing Other Words for Home, which was a book that I read my summer semester 2023 of grad school for the young adult literature. I'm trying to think of what the other option was, and I feel like it was when I was looking up designs to make the cover for this episode, I remember seeing that other option, but I can't remember. But our teacher tried to keep kind of thematically the same, or our people groups the same, so I'm sure it was someone of Middle Eastern descent. But I thought, you know, this is, given the time that we had been recording and what was going on, I thought, I think this would be a good novel because it is a bit lighter, but it has serious topics that we can discuss. And like I said before, we've not, I don't think, had this sort of representation on our show. So it's checking lots of boxes that I think our show needs.
No, the closest we've come is Persepolis.
Ah, true. Did we do one and two? It's been so long.
No, we just did one.
Okay. So, yes. And this would be this is our second, I think, novel in
verse.
Yes. Yeah. Like, in poetic form.
Yeah, we did the Poet X fairly recently, too, right?
Yes. Yeah. And I think that this is distinct enough that there's only minor overlap in terms of genre, but I think that they are two completely different works. But at least there is that connection, and we'll obviously talk about using that medium instead of others. But let's just dive into this. So I'll talk a bit about the author, and then also I looked up, because I am not well, it's like one of my flaws as a human is that like current events are just not my thing. So as in, I just don't make time to do it. It's bad. I should be doing it. But I found a simple guide to what's happening in Syria on CNN, and then a little bit about Aleppo. So just to give us context, but it's ironic that I'm saying all of that, because one of the reasons why Warga wanted to write this is because she knew the ignorance of people regarding this topic. She herself even says in kind of the author's like note at the end that she was unaware of the extent of things that was going on there. So I think that's another reason why, and this is true of all literature, why this is such a great book, because I think it does make us more knowledgeable in a smaller way and in a different way, rather than like hitting us over the head with different things, but more knowledgeable about Syria and what is slash was going on, and hopefully whets our appetite or makes us want to learn more and go out of our way to research. So as far as like, because it could probably be exhaustive, and I'm sure that there are people, I'm sure Tom knows more about Syria, but I just thought, well, CNN, this looks like a good little source that I can use, so I'll just go with that. So yes, on Jasmine Warga's bio, she has her professional bio, and then she has her longer informal bio. I'll go with her longer slash informal bio. So she was born April 24th, 1988 in Cincinnati, Ohio. She is proud of her Midwestern city. And she talks about different places in Ohio that people of that place would actually know. Growing up, she loved to read. When she was younger, she read every book that she could get her hands on, like Charlotte's Web, The Witches, and Anne of Green Gables, that were all her favorites. She read The Bridge to Terabithia in fourth grade, and that's the first book that she remembers reading by herself that made her cry. In middle school, she was reading Sharon Draper and Margaret Peterson Haddix and fell in love with those stories and wanted to live in the world of Ella Enchanted and The Giver. And then in high school, she was introduced to the works of Virginia Woolf, and her brain exploded, as she says. She fell hard and fast for the poetry of Adrienne Rich and Anne Sexton. And then in college, discovered Zadie Smith and Sandra Cisneros, which, of course, we have covered on this show. Yep. And reading their brilliant writing made her really incited her own desire to tell stories that felt possible in a way that it hadn't before. So she went to college with the intention of getting a degree in something quote-unquote practical, because she wanted to make her parents happy, but ended up graduating with a degree in art history and history, which she says, if you really think about it, was just a roundabout way for me to study the structure of story and how stories are told. After graduation, she found a job teaching sixth grade science to a bunch of smart and challenging students in Texas, and while teaching, she started to try her hand at writing her own stories. Lots of false starts, messy drafts. Here we are. She said she feels extremely lucky with everything that she has done. And currently she is living in Chicago with her family. She is the number one New York Times bestselling author of middle grade novels, Other Words for Home, The Shape of Thunder, and A Rover Story. Other Words for Home earned multiple awards, including a John Newbery honor, a Walter honor for young readers, and a Charlotte Huck honor. The Shape of Thunder was a school library journal and Bank Street Best Book of the Year, a finalist for the Barnes & Noble Children's and YA Book Award, and has been named to several state award reading lists. And A Rover Story, her latest novel, was an instant New York Times bestseller, an Indie Next List, and a Junior Library Guild selection, and was named a Best Book of the Year by Publishers Weekly and The Washington Post. She's also the author of young adult novel My Heart and Other Black Holes, which has been translated into over 20 different languages. And her next middle grade novel, A Strange Thing Happened in Cherry Hall, has been published on September 10th, 2024. So just to give you a sense of who that is. And I will say, in terms of this book, given the author's note. She was invited to, she says that the first inkling of the idea that would later become Other Words for Home came to her in the fall of 2013 when she was invited over to a close family friend's house for dinner. At this dinner, she was introduced to members of her extended family who had recently come over from Syria to escape the violence that was threatening their hometown. She learned more about the conflict in Syria, which up until then she only had a vague awareness of, and at this dinner she watched as cousins who were raised in America interacted with cousins who had been raised in Syria. And it made her think about families like her own, her father's from Jordan, who live on different sides of an ocean, but at that time she was writing another book, so she took that away for later. And then flashing forward to fall of 2016, the atrocities of the war in Syria had been splashed across the front pages of many American and European newspapers, and more of the world was aware of what was happening. Yet the silence in response to the suffering of an entire population felt deafening. Why didn't more people care? Why didn't more people want to help? These questions scared her. They made her confront things that she had long ago buried within herself. Knowledge of prejudice against Arabs and Arab Americans, Islamophobia, and America's often cool indifference to the suffering of brown people. So she very much found Jude's voice, thinking of her family as well as writing Jude for her 12-year-old self, who never saw a brown girl in a book, who is proud of her family and where she came from. But she says she's ashamed to admit that growing up she was more like Sarah, Jude's cousin, than Jude. Through societal conditioning, she says, I learned to be a little afraid and a little embarrassed of my father's culture. I never was exposed to any media that told me to feel otherwise. So she wrote this book as a way to tell herself, both past and present versions, that as an Arab American girl, her dreams, hopes, and fears are as valid as anyone else's. That the Jews of the world deserve to have their stories told. We're in a period of human history where empathy is needed more than ever, which I thought was also powerful. And then, yes, let me switch over to what is going on. So I feel like this might be happening in the past, even though this came out in 2019. Just with things that are happening, because like reading this, what I'll talk about, you know, what's happening in Syria. It seems like maybe this is happening in 2011. But you can let me know because you're probably more knowledgeable right now. So, Syria's civil war, this is from CNN. At the height of the Arab Spring in 2011, pro-democracy demonstrators took to the streets in Syria calling for the ouster of its authoritarian president, Bashar al-Assad. The protesters were met with deadly force. So that's because, that is why I'm saying like 2011, because if you remember, ISA is all about getting rid of that president and everything.
Yeah.
The protesters were met with deadly force as Assad's forces crushed a pro-democracy movement and armed opposition began to form made up of small organic militias and some defectors from the Syrian military. The opposition forces, decentralized, made up of different ideologies but with the common goal of toppling Assad, were supported in various ways by foreign powers including neighboring Turkey, regional giant Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, as well as the United States. So look, we're sticking our nose in other people's business again. As the anti-government forces grew, Syria's allies, Iran and Russia, stepped up their support. On the ground, Iran's Revolutionary Guard, as well as its Lebanese proxy, Hezbollah, helped fight the armed rebel groups. In the skies, the Syrian Air Force was bolstered by Russian warplanes. Extremist Islamists, including al-Qaeda, took an interest in Syria, taking up a common cause with the moderate Syrian opposition, who did not welcome jihadist involvement. But by 2014, the extremists dominated and ISIS began sweeping across the country. Fearing Syria would become a permanent terror hotbed, an international coalition led by the U.S. stepped in with the force of eliminating the group, but without confronting the Syrian regime. The Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, but not to be confused with Robotech, a U.S. partner made up of Kurdish fighters, fought against ISIS, effectively ending the group's territorial existence. In 2020, Russia and Turkey agreed a ceasefire in the last remaining opposition-held province, Idlib, agreeing to establish a security corridor with joint patrols. There have been no major flare-ups since then, but Syria's government never regained all of its territory, and as events in Aleppo show, armed resistance never went away. And then I'll skip over to the Battle of Aleppo just to give sense, because Aleppo is where Issa goes.
Yeah.
And it's everyone knows, and I think even Jude says in the book that Aleppo means death.
Got a lot of it got an enormous amount of coverage.
Yeah.
I'm forgetting the year, so hopefully you can kind of shed some light on that.
Yeah, so the Battle of Aleppo, according to Wikipedia, was between 2012 and 2016. And it was a major military confrontation in Aleppo, the largest city in Syria, between the Syrian opposition, which included the Free Syrian Army and other largely Sunni groups, such as the Levant Front and the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Al-Nusra Front, against the Syria government that was supported by Hezbollah, Shia militias, and Russia, and against the Kurdish majority People's Protection Units. It was a part of the ongoing Syrian civil war, and a stalemate that had been in place for 4 years finally ended in July 2016 when Syrian government troops closed the rebels' last supply line into Aleppo with the support of Russian airstrikes. The Syrian government victory which happened in November, was seen as a turning point in this particular civil war. It was named as the Mother of Battles or Syria's Stalingrad because of its large-scale devastation and how important it was to the combatants. There was widespread violence against civilians, repeated targeting of hospitals and schools, mostly by pro-government air forces and to a lesser extent the rebels, and indiscriminate aerial strikes and shelling against civilian areas. It was also marked by the inability of the international community to resolve the conflict peacefully. The UN Special Envoy to Syria proposed to end the battle by giving East Aleppo autonomy, but this was rejected by the Syrian governments. So hundreds of thousands of residents were displaced by the fighting, and efforts to provide aid to civilians or facilitate evacuation were routinely disrupted by continued combat and mistrust between the opposing sides. Refugees, I think it's mentioned that people would be fleeing because of the stuff that had been going on within that book. We know that her friend Fatima leaves, that family also leaves. So yeah, lots of unfortunate things happening that I was unaware of, unfortunately.
You were trying to figure out like when the book was taking place. You said it was published in 2016 or you
published
said 2020?
In 2019.
2019.
And I'm thinking maybe around this time, 2011 maybe.
Yeah, 2011, 2012. It's 2016 would be too late because it seems like her brother is like in the middle of everything. So things aren't over. Maybe they've been just starting. The other thing is that I would imagine that if this were taking place in 2016, there would be some mention about the presidential election that happened back then, because there was a lot of fear among, especially in early 2017, among Muslim communities over whether or not they would be able to remain in the country, et cetera. And, you know, there was just which just currently fear about that right now, too. So, I think you're right. Maybe 2011, 2012, 2013 would probably be a good target here for like what year this is happening.
Yeah. After 4 years of fighting, the battle represents one of the longest sieges in modern warfare and one of the bloodiest battles of the Syrian civil war, leaving over 31,000 people dead, almost a tenth of the estimated overall war casualties at that time. An estimated 33,500 buildings have either been damaged or destroyed, and it is considered one of the worst urban battles fought in the 21st century due to its length and destruction. So, I'm happy for the sake of Jude and her mother, and at the time, her unborn sister, that they got out of there. But yeah, I still worry about Issa and Baba and whether they'll come over. But we can talk about that and what we think happens to them if we would like. Anything else that you would like to add?
No, only that. So we're recording this in mid-December of 2024. Just last week, Assad was overthrown. And then we are not entirely sure how this is going to play out.
Okay. So I will now move on to the plot synopsis. This is broken up into six parts. Part number one, changing. Jude is a 12-year-old girl who lives in a city in Syria on the Mediterranean Sea. There are many tourists in her city, but her father never allows her to talk to them, men, or anybody she does not know. Unlike many places in Syria, Jude's city, which is not as large or bustling, is safe from the war. Jude lives in an apartment across the courtyard from her extended family, and her best friend is her cousin, Fatima, with whom she eats her afternoon snack. They like to watch old movies from the United States together. As Jude enjoys her childhood, meeting a new friend with Fatima and exploring the city, she hears about the Syrian civil war from her older brother, Issa. She feels like her brother is changing too much as he attends protests, and she hears about the horrors of the war from her father. Issa later moves out of the apartment. When his new apartment is raided by the police, the city becomes less safe and police are everywhere. Jude's mother tells her that she's pregnant and it is time to leave Syria. They say goodbye to Jude's father, Issa, Fatima, and Auntie Amal. Jude promises Fatima that she will never forget her, and Issa that she will be brave. Part 2, Arriving. Jude and her mother fly to Cincinnati, Ohio, in a plane. They go through the immigration process at the airport. Jude feels lucky, but heartbroken to be leaving her father and brother. She meets her uncle Mazen, Aunt Michelle, and cousin Sarah. Aunt Michelle welcomes Jude as soon as she sees her. On the drive home to their house in Clifton, a neighborhood in Cincinnati, Sarah makes fun of how Jude speaks English. They arrive at the old three-story house where the family lives, in an area with many trees and hills. Uncle Mazen shows Jude all of his technology in his study. Jude watches a movie with Sarah, and she thinks that they are becoming friends until she hears a comment that Sarah makes to Aunt Michelle. She continues to be amazed by her new home, even though she feels grief from leaving her family, and Aunt Michelle is very nice to her. She takes Jude and Sarah out to eat at a French restaurant. Jude has some conflicts with her mother about adjustments to life in Cincinnati. Part 3, Staying. Aunt Michelle drops off Jude and Sarah at school. Jude is given a schedule but struggles to read it and is late to math, where she has difficulty with the problems because she has to explain them. Jude finds her safety in her ESL class, where there are students like her who do not speak English as their first language, and the teacher is nice. Sarah is not friendly to Jude and does not invite her to sit with her friends at lunch. However, she gets to know the students in her ESL class: Ben from China, Grace from South Korea, and Omar from Somalia. Jude also gets to know Uncle Mazen when he takes her out to a steakhouse, and Sarah becomes friendlier when she invites Jude to her room. I disagree with that. That was some information that she was trying to gather. Her mother learns more English, and they practice conversation together. Jude discovers Ludlow Avenue, a busy street in Cincinnati, and she finds a restaurant called Alibaba, which is Middle Eastern. She meets a girl named Layla, who is in eighth grade, a year older, and whose parents are from Lebanon. They become friends, and as Jude gets more confident, she adjusts to her new home. Her mother makes fried cauliflower for dinner and brings cuisine from Syria to the table, where it is enjoyed. Layla later tells Jude that there is a school musical. She goes to a meeting and considers joining the stage crew, as Layla suggests, but also gets a packet with tryout instructions. Jude begins to learn more English, but as she improves, she gets the terrible news from her mother that Issa has moved to a more dangerous city. She is scared and wants information. As Thanksgiving approaches, Jude learns about giving thanks, and she has new hope. Part 4, Hoping. Jude writes letters to Fatima and awaits a response from her. She goes to her mother's ultrasonogram appointment, sees the baby on the screen, and hears its heartbeat. They are overjoyed to discover that it is a girl. On their way to the hospital, a woman tells Jude's mother that she doesn't have to wear her hijab anymore, but Jude knows that they are happy. Winter comes, and Jude practices her monologue. She talks about the play when she goes sledding with Sarah and her friends. Layla tells Jude that she can't try out for the play because her English is not good, but Jude does not agree. She practices I Will Always Love You by Whitney Houston, which she used to sing with Issa. Jude chooses her monologue from Notting Hill, a Julia Roberts movie that she watched. Jude discovers that Fatima has not responded to her letters because her mother has hidden them, but she practices for the tryout with her mother and forgets her. She tries out with determination and ferocity. As she waits for the results, Jude gets her period and she wears the hijab. And right there is the reason why I chose this book, so that I could make Tom talk about periods once again. Part 5, Growing. Jude's father cries when he sees her in the hijab on the video call. Layla's mother is very happy, the ESL teacher is too, and Aunt Michelle is a little suspicious about whether or not Jude was forced to wear it. Shortly after, Jude finds out that she got a part as Plumet in the play, so it's clear that it was Beauty and the Beast, and Sarah made the chorus. They are broken up into groups at the first practice. Jude is with Ethan, who is the star. Ruth, who works on sets, and Miles, a boy from her math class who wears space shirts. She gets to know Miles and eats pizza with him at dinner. On Valentine's Day, Jude hears about the war in the Middle East from Layla, and she is afraid. Jude experiences discrimination, Islamophobia, and bigotry for being Muslim. However, she becomes great friends with Miles and meets his dog. Ali Baba is vandalized, and Layla stops talking to Jude. She finds solace in ESL class. At play practice, Jude tells Miles about Issa, and he is understanding. Jude also becomes closer to Uncle Mazen. She gets a postcard from Fatima, who is in Beirut, and her mother organizes a fundraiser for Ali Baba, and Jude makes up with Layla. Part 6. Living. Jude hears from Ben that he has become a citizen of the United States, and she feels that everything is becoming easier. She's at play practice later when Uncle Mazen comes to get her and Sarah, telling them that the baby is coming. Jude finally meets her sister, who has been named Amal, for the first time. Everyone falls in love with her. Jude's mother finds a way to call Issa, and he tells them... I would say that Issa found a way to call her. But anyways, Jude's mother finds a way to call Issa, and he tells them about what he is doing. There's conflict about where he will go. Jude attends the final play practice and goes out onto the stage on opening night. She has learned to be brave. And that is Other Words for Home. So question number one, young man, did you like it?
I did. It took me a little while to get into it.
Oh,
then it started to pick up a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think it was just settling into having read, you know, the last couple of books have been pretty big, right? And then kind of settling into a middle grade novel and verse. I was just like, okay. And then once I kind of got into the right head space, I was good to go. Cause I'd actually never heard of this book or even read it prior to you picking for it. So this was my first shot at it. No, I did enjoy it. I kind of wanted it to keep going.
Oh, sure.
But I get why it ends with the moment that it does.
Yes. I guess I forgot. I apologize to ask about history. As I said, I read this in the summer of 2023, and I really loved it. I instantly fell in love with Jude. And this, along with that book you lent me about Robin... Ha from South Korea. What's that called? The graphic novel?
It's in my classroom. I don't have it right here, but I know which one you're talking about. It has a blue cover.
Yes. That's okay. American girl. Both of those, I guess we'll find out at some point. Really helped me, I think, better understand ESL students and like their perspective and what they're going through. And this was right before I started. It would have been my second year at the same district high school that you are at. Well, not the same high school, but within that same district. And then I was like with more ESL students. So I think I gained a better understanding and more empathy for them. But yeah, I just really love this. And like I said, it was a completely different group of people that I had not read before. And I just thought Jude was so cute and lovable. And I was just on her side the entire time and really hoping for her and really proud of her when she was brave and everything and powerful language. And it is different than The Poet X, cause it's middle grade. So I think you can feel that a little bit more, but I don't think that takes away from the power of its message and some lines that really punch you, I think.
No, I agree. Almost American Girl is the name of the novel.
Look, a little quick Google helped us out.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. I was trying not to compare it to other novels in verse that I've read, especially The Poet X, because we just read that, which I think is for an older audience than the middle grades. It's clearly Poet X is clearly for a high school and up audience and reads like that. And that's where I think The Poet X is a little bit richer when it comes to the actual poetry that Elizabeth Acevedo is writing. But I still enjoyed this as far as a novel in verse is concerned. It didn't feel like the author was just kind of stringing a bunch of words together to create a quote poem. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So yeah. And you know, I've never taught an English as a second language class, but I've known plenty of students who have EL accommodations. I've taught plenty of them as well. And I've taught a few Muslim students who Jude reminded me of a little bit, which was really cool. One of whom graduated about 2 years ago And I remember seeing, because I had her as a freshman, like right when we shut down for COVID. And then I saw her on graduation night. She got in a full ride to UVA. And I had the opportunity to see her and tell her how proud I was of her. And that was really, really special. And then I have a student this year who actually reminds me a lot of her. And she's like the nicest kid. And she's really, really into like what we're doing and working on, you know, whatever we're doing and stuff like that. So it's like, it's cool to see those kids in a book like this.
Yes, 100%. I think, you know, I always try to make my classroom comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that that's true of every teacher, though some teachers can do it, I think, better than others. And it's more than just those words. But I realize that when however comfortable you might make this classroom, it could be really loving, that some ESL or ELL students just might not speak up because they are super embarrassed about making a mistake. And so having those sections of within that math class where Jude knows the math, but being forced to explain it is what's holding her back. I totally understood and like, or it helped me understand like why some even, you know, might be saying, please, you know, it's okay if you mess up, that it's, you might be saying that, but for them it could be really traumatizing.
Yeah.
And that the ESL room is such a safe space. I think that's the teacher that hopefully they latch on to the most, because you have to forge that bond with that teacher. And then having these fellow students that are of different backgrounds but going through the same thing, I think is wonderful, because then she doesn't feel as isolated. So I felt like it really gets to some important points about not speaking English as your primary language and a student in middle school or high school.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I mean, let's start off, I think, talking about the pros. And this was a question that you asked with the poet X.
Uh-huh.
Using verse instead of prose, how does that add to this novel? Would it have changed if it were in prose?
That is a good question. The second one's a good question, because I think it would have felt rushed. I feel like the poetry, or the format of the poetry in this, is Jude speaking to us in English in a way that is kind of mirrors like her own journey, like in terms of the language. So it has a sort of, it's not as fast and matter of fact, et cetera, that you would have as a narrator, as descriptive as a narrator who is a prose, you know, prose narrator. And I'm doing my best to come up with like a really good answer here, but I can't really think of anything beyond the fact that it just seemed to fit. Mm-hmm. the poetry seemed to fit with the story better than what would have been her narration as far as a prose, if it was written in prose.
Yeah, I think two answers for me is that when you're using one will be like in universe and one's out of your universe. When you're using verse, you have to get to the point immediately, mm-hmm. and every word is treasured. And you are picking each word in particular. Like, I'm just thinking about
word economy.
100%. Like, I'm just thinking about, you know, I'm doing a survey of poetry with my Latin 4/5s. I think about the Aeneid. And because they have a certain amount, like, they have to fit in the scansion. They have to be very precise in what they're choosing. Like, this is what this is. With prose, you can be as verbose as you want and fill it, everything. So that's my out-of-universe explanation. My in-universe explanation is it works really well for someone who is learning English. In that, I think if it were prose and she was really putting everything out there, we would expect it to be in Arabic, right? Because that is her first language and her strongest yeah. language. But here it's like the way that it is, and that it's at time choppy, or she's like finding the words and the types of words she uses, like that's probably what someone that is learning English would also be doing. Yeah, so that's my in-universe explanation as well for that. I think that it works really well in kind of like the pausing, because, you know, they work through like what word do I actually mean, and there are these maybe pauses within sentences and things like that, and so I felt it there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so those are my two. Okay. Lucky is a word Jude encounters in America. Quote, I am learning how to say it over and over in English. I'm learning how it tastes sweet with promise and bitter with responsibility. What do you think she means by this?
I like the last part of that. I'm learning how it tastes sweet with promise and bitter with responsibility. That if you don't take advantage of this luck that has been handed to you, you're somehow failing. That there should be some sort of gratitude toward being having the fortune that you have in this country. And the sweet with promise, it's kind of obvious. Like, you know, that's the contrast between where she is and where she came from, right? You know, that there's so much potential when you get here because there is, compared to where I was, not only so much freedom in terms of my rights, but freedom in terms of like my ability to just simply live daily, right? Like where I'm not coming from a place where I'm in danger anymore. So, lucky, and what's interesting is lucky is not the best word for it. Because I think that's kind of, it's a little condescending in a sense, if you think about it. Like when you're saying, oh, you're lucky, it's a little, it's a backhanded compliment in that sense, right? There's a fortune that she has, but at the same time, it's not like she hasn't struggled or her family hasn't struggled to for this or that. Lucky implies it's unearned. That's what I was going for. And I don't think her situation here is unearned. And I think that's where we get that juxtaposition of the sweet and the bitter from it. And I think that's a really cool line.
And I will just add that luck, I think, is co so contextual and depending on the situation, because I think both Fatima and Jude were lucky where they were in Syria compared to other people, like people maybe closer to the conflict zone in Aleppo. And then suddenly, then Jude and her mother are lucky that they are able to get into the, America, compared to, I guess, if they lock down the borders, which at one point Layla was like, "You're not, people aren't going to be let in now." So it shifts, like who is lucky and who is not lucky. But then at the other side, like Jude might be considered unlucky in terms of post-conflict, like sudden, and she's wearing her headscarf that. Now, she's going to be targeted, that sort of thing. So it just shifts. It totally depends. But yeah, I think it was frustrating whenever, I feel like Layla used this a lot. Like, you're lucky that you kind of have a foot in both worlds, and Layla wanted to have that stronger connection, but she never went to Syria. She was born in America. But yeah, I feel like I hear that a lot from her. I don't know that Sarah ever said, well, maybe she did in terms of, no, I don't think she ever said that. I was thinking like when Jude was able to go to the steakhouse with her uncle, Sarah was upset about that. I don't know if she used the word lucky, but I think you're right that it is, yeah, and how it's used from other people, like, oh, it wasn't like, oh, you're so lucky. It's like, you're lucky.
Yeah, oh, you're lucky. Yeah,
Yeah.
it
Are you
is.
thinking about your privilege? And it's like, my gosh, she's
Yes,
a
that's
12-year-old
another.
child.
No, I know, but hey, there, we've both been on social media
I
enough to see
know.
that, so.
Yeah, 100%. So this is the who even knows, fourth, fifth infinity number novel that we're going to talk about, periods. So Jude starts her, I think Fatima had already started hers at the beginning of this novel. That was like a difference between the two of them. And so she starts her period, and she had packed up some headscarves for when this would happen, and now she begins wearing her job as a rite of passage. And so the question here is, and I do have a question about the hijab, do Western girls have a similar rite of passage, and should they? And then also, did you, when you were reading the sections about the woman outside of the store saying, or it might have been the doctor's office saying, like, you don't have to wear that anymore, and Aunt Michelle's dubiousness about her, about Jude choosing to wear it, did you rethink, let's say American feminist movement of like trying to rid the hijab and like free women from it. Did you rethink the motives behind that and the people wearing the hijab? So two separate things, but I just wondered if you had rethought that.
I mean, the second question, I don't know if I rethought it because it's not beyond the pale to just come across, somebody who has the same beliefs as you do in terms of like political affiliation, like feminism, for instance, but they're really self-righteous in that sort of way. And that's the feeling I got from the, you don't have to wear that anymore type of thing. You know, that they're, this person's just kind of flexing their self-righteousness. I'm a white male, so it's hard for me to kind of pass a judgment, but I'm looking at the way it's portrayed here, and I'm seeing it as a mark of tradition for her, a choice that her family now has. She has the choice to make because she probably didn't have it in Syria. It's a sense of her identity that I think she seems to value and that her mother raised her to value. So it seems like in the context here that the hijab, the way her mother raised her, was something to be prideful of and not a mark of shame. You know what I mean? Like I think that sometimes we take the look of the headscarf and the hijab, like, you know, et cetera. And we do attach these ideas that we have of oppression and shame and things like that. And I think we get a perspective here that does not buy into that opinion. So I thought that was really interesting. I also, by the way, had no idea that you started. And I don't know if this is across the whole Muslim world or not, but at least in this case, the idea of starting to wear the hijab when you got your period, had no idea there was a connection there. Because I get the feeling that in our culture, starting your period for the first time or getting your period for the first time is not celebrated. In fact, it's been a source of shame. It's been the butt of jokes. It's been something to hide, and to the point where we have to have, like, we have a student charity in our, or student charity or student advocacy group in our the school where I teach, where they are collecting menstrual products to put in bathrooms so that girls don't feel, you know, can feel comfortable, you know, going to the bathroom if they're without something like a tampon or a pad or something. And I think for years and years and years, and hopefully it's changing, I just get the feeling that in this country, in our culture, your period is something that is not something to be proud of. And it's something you obviously do endure as a woman because it can be very, very painful. But I get the feeling that it's just not something, it's something that we don't talk about them. It's because it also indicates sex in some way, you know, like we kind of go down that road because the people who obsess over these things are perverted and they're always like connecting everything to sex. But anyway, so I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, I will say in terms of the place of business that Tom attends, that those tampons are cardboard applicators. So that's probably why they're collecting actual good stuff. But then when we say good stuff, remember that there's cyanide and lead in tampons now.
Yeah, I know.
I shouldn't say now. It's been there for forever. So, you know, we're dying a slow death either way. But you're absolutely correct about the sentence shame. I would say that it's hard to say about this, you know, should there be like a celebration? Because then I feel like with the creepazoids, are they now like, there's like this transition that, oh, and now you're a woman. So, you know, I can start treating you differently. So I do worry about that side. If the world weren't fallen, then I think, yes, you know, we should celebrate it. But because, the womanhood and the tie to sex, I think it kind of perverts it.
Well, there's a difference though between privacy and shame. Like if you feel that, like, as a person, if you want to keep this to yourself and it's private, even if you're proud of it, that's like totally your thing. You don't have to celebrate it, but you shouldn't feel shameful. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So. And I will say that this book actually really made me rethink my viewpoint on headscarves and hijabs, because I very much was in the line of this woman who stopped, I wouldn't do that, but stopped in the street and Aunt Michelle, that it was a sign of oppression. And, you know, as someone who is for women, like, I want to free you from that. But then recognizing, like, but wait, like, some of these, like, people have a choice, and that it's different. It's for some communities, which even Jude gets into, some communities it is oppression, and some it is more of a celebration, as you were saying. And so she is choosing to wear this, and so that is her freedom, which connects with other things, like, we just want, you know, freedom of choice. So it, yeah, really made me rethink that, which I really appreciated.
I like how Jude did explain that in some communities it is a mark of oppression, and some it is a choice and something to be proud of, because that helps the reader learn one more little thing that does not paint the entire Islam, religion of Islam and Muslim people who practice it with an enormously broad brush. Because it's like one of the biggest religions in the world, or if not the biggest, I don't know what the numbers are, but it's not just in the Middle East. Like, Indonesia and India have huge Muslim populations, as is Pakistan, and then you have the Arabia, Morocco and Egypt and stuff like that. So then there's like all sorts of differences between different sects and things like that. So the fact that she did explain that, even if it's just a simple thing, I think allows the reader, especially if it's a middle grade reader, to really pick up on the idea of, though there are differences between us, even though we have the same religion or et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely. How is food used in this novel? As someone who loves the massacre in the Odyssey that is compared to a feast, and the slaughters compared to different, yeah, food things, how is it used here?
Gonna kill everybody in this room. I love the end of the Odyssey. You know, it's used in a couple of different ways. Like, there's the idea of food as a status thing. When her uncle takes her to the steakhouse, for instance, it's him showing off, right? Like, it's him being like, you know, I've been successful and I'm rolling in money and I can take you to this really, really expensive place. But it's also, of course, in a way that we've seen it tons of times before in other books and movies and things, used as an identifier, something that is part of you and part of your culture and part of your home. I mean, she meets her best friend because she stumbles upon the best friend's restaurant and has been, her friend like takes her in. You know, I don't think she pays for that first meal that she has
No, I don't
with
know
her.
that she pays for any of the snacks, but she does end up helping out at
Yeah,
Alibaba,
it
so.
sounds like she works there, but it's really, really cool that way. And I thought it was a really good way to show once again the community that surrounds food. I mean, I've watched so many food and travel shows that go to a little, you know, like a Muslim area or a Vietnam town or a Chinatown or some community within a city, like whether it be Chicago or New York or Las Vegas or San Francisco or something, and just talks about, you know, who's there and who's making the food and what they do and what they celebrate and how they help each other. So that idea of food and community is, it's so cross-cultural too, right? And I like the fact that that was brought in here, and it was a place for her to find comfort and solace at a really, really rough time.
100%. Yeah, having that connection to home, as well as, and I think also giving us insight into each of those characters to see where they are on their emotional journey. Because I can't tell the race slash ethnicity slash nationality of Aunt Michelle.
I just think she's a blonde white woman, isn't she?
I guess from France.
Yeah, or something.
Because they met at university. But yeah, she
Yeah.
doesn't, I feel like she's not Middle Eastern. I don't think that
No.
she's brown.
No.
But that's, we weren't really told. And so Sarah, then I'm like, okay. So, because I think at one point it said like the only thing she got from her dad was like dark hair, question mark. Oh, because I think that there was a beautiful moment where talking about Baby Amal and that she looks like us and that, you know, like all of the family. And then Ju says, oh, you think that we look alike? And so I think there's a nice moment there. So Sarah might be brown, question mark, but also might be maybe lighter in skin and can pass. I don't know. Because her friends, I can't tell. It's hard to tell. I guess it doesn't really matter. But if you want Jude to feel out of place, then I'm assuming that everyone else in her life is either white or white passing, with the exception of Layla. But anyways, I think it tells us where they are, because Aunt Michelle is obsessed with the French food. Uncle Mazin, who's very much like, this is home now, is like taking her to American, and will compare things with Syrian fare, but to the detriment of Syrian fare. Like, I think he's with the steak was bleeding, and Jude was like, ew, this is gross. And he said that in Syria, they overcooked it. And then finally, with the mother being able to provide a meal,
yeah,
bringing that comfort in, as well as sharing it with the family. And then the food that, yeah, Jude gets with Alibaba, at Alibaba with Layla and her family, has that connection as well. So, yeah, definitely culture, definitely home. It tells us, I think, where the people are. Pizza being, you know, like very American, and she loves it. But I think it's also coming at a really important moment, because it's play practice. So it's like this, all this stuff that she's really becoming American and getting to know this place and culture better. Yeah. So all of the things, I think it's used really well.
By the way, page 68, welcome to America. She says her voice sounds like an American movie star, clear and sprinkled with sugar. She looks like an American movie star too. Honey blonde hair, big light eyes, casual elegance.
There you go.
I was picturing a kind of tallish, thin, blonde woman. I could see the actress on like television or movie, but I can't put a name on it. But yeah, so there's that. So that's what she looks like. So Sarah would be mixed in that regard, yeah. I guess.
So we'll move on to Sarah. Okay. Why do you think that she acts so unwelcoming to Jude, both in the house as well as, well, very much outside of the house, where she ignores Jude when she's with her friends? She doesn't invite Jude to sit with her at lunch, that sort of thing. What do you think of the way their relationship develops towards the end?
Well, the first part, the answer to the first part of the question is just, she's a middle school girl. So she's kind of a brat, right? So she's just like, why do they have to be here? And like, I'm going to ignore you, like, because she has her place and she doesn't want her things disrupted. And, you know, who is this intruder? So part of it, I think, is being defensive. Part of it is being selfish, you know, because she is what, 13 years old, and she is, and 13 year old middle school girls tend to be like that. And I know I'm painting with a broad brush there, but the relationship, it's interesting because it feels realistic to me. It's like they're kind of friendlier at the end, toward the end, but they're not like besties. And I feel that that's how things would happen. It would be too maudlin to have them be like, you know, best friends by the end of the book, because there's a lot of conflict between the two of them. And a lot of it is Sarah, and Sarah has a real hang up. In a way that, we don't have like an omniscient narrator to get Sarah's perspective, because you wonder, is she slightly embarrassed by the fact that her father is Muslim? Because it doesn't indicate whether or not she is, right? Is she, or that her mother's converted or something, like, unless I missed that.
Well, I mean, her uncle's not even attending mosque.
Yeah. So it's kind of irreligious, right? They're not really practicing anything. And I wonder if you were to dig deeper into Sarah's character, is there an amount of shame over being like having that in your family based on the racism that exists toward, you know, Muslim people, brown people in this country. So yeah. But yeah, no, it's a very strained, getting a little bit better, but I like how it doesn't automatically become like we're best friends forever at the end.
No. And I think there's jealousy, which is also, because I think that's just what I'll add so I don't repeat everything that you said. But I think it just happens, because at first it's just this person I don't really have to care about. But then, well, why is my father taking my cousin out to this fancy restaurant where he may or may not have taken me out before, but he doesn't really spend time with me, sort of thing. And jealous that there's that connection between culture. And then later on that Jude gets a part in the musical, mm-hmm. and that's unheard of for seventh graders. And then she's just Sarah's just in the chorus and her other friends don't. So I think there is some jealousy as well. But I hope that she sees that there's like no ill intent, you know.
Yeah.
That Jude is just so sweet and kind, and it's like you're beating a kitten or a puppy dog. And I think Amal really, as babies, well, they can be divisive, but also I think often babies romantically, you know, bring people together. And I think in this case, the first like American naturally born, is that what's called, natural born citizen of that family, which is beautiful. And yeah, a nice little connection. And you're right. Yeah. Let's not force them into being BFFs. I don't know that she'll ever be in that circle, because I think Sarah's very much a popular girl and she'll remain that the entire way. And Jude just loves hanging out with kind of the weirdos.
Yeah.
Which I wouldn't consider Layla a weirdo, but Sarah would because of her hijab. But probably everyone's going to consider Miles a weirdo. Even Miles considers himself a little weirdo. So, yeah. But yeah. Hopefully she doesn't, lie about like, oh yeah, that's my, I can't remember. It was either a TV show or a book I read where someone never told anyone that they were related. And then it like came out at some point and it was disastrous for them. I can't remember what
that sounds familiar.
Didn't we do something with that? Siblings or something. And like, they just, no one ever knew because they never associated with each other. And then something happened. We'll figure it out. But I swear, either a book or a film or a TV show where that is true. And then it came out and you're like, what? You're related? But anyways, so I could imagine that might happen. Okay, we shall move on. The job. Oh, the play. So two different things about the play, I think. First of all, Layla discourages Jude from trying out for the play. Why do you think she does this? And then secondly, what are some ways that Jude connects with her character, Plumette?
I think Layla is trying to protect her. She's mm-hmm. being protected. I thought she'd protect her from embarrassment. I also think Layla is also projecting her own fear and maybe regret of not, like, it seems like Layla just kind of settled into the role of like, you know, I get to be the stage person and not the on the stage, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe secretly wanted to do it, but she never had the guts to. So she's kind of projecting a little bit. I don't know about the role she plays. Why don't you go ahead and take that one? Because I'm blanking.
Sure. Plumette. Do you know who Plumette is? When's the last time you saw Beauty and the Beast?
Oh, a very long time ago.
Okay. She's like the sensual French feather duster.
Okay.
That has kind of an on again, off again, flirtatious relationship with
Lumiere is the candlestick.
Yes, I think voiced by David Hyde Pierce, but I can't remember. So I agree with you. Yeah, I think trying to protect her, I don't know if there's anything malicious there. The only thing I wonder, if when you have a friend and you connect with them so much, again, kind of jealous, that you don't want to like let them go off and do something else because you feel like you might lose them. So mm-hmm. I wonder if there's also a part of that, like she feels if she does this, that is a world that she cannot participate in. And so she'll kind of leave her, which was a conflict. That was the ending conflict of them anyways, or the reason why they quote unquote broke up is because she felt like she didn't fully understand. Jude didn't fully understand Layla, and then told her that she would leave one day, and then she did have to leave. She had to leave the restaurant, that sort of thing. So perhaps there's that fear as well. But I think also, yeah, you know, will people make fun of you? And then that connection, because I'm like you. So will that blow back to me? As for Plumette, obviously, I think that the sexuality part is not, does not connect to Jude being flirtatious and everything. But I think very much being brave. being brave to be flirtatious, as well as someone who does have an accent, even though it's a different nation. That's more of a superficial thing. I'm trying to think about being a feather duster. That, you know, a feather duster takes care of people, getting rid of dust, takes care of things. And she, Jude, I think, very much felt like she was taking care of her mother and her unborn sister at the time, too. So I think there are some connections there. But I like how the drama teacher said something about, like, you, I can tell you have, what was the word? It wasn't spark? Leaders of it?
Spunk?
I do remember. Yeah, it might have been spunk. And she said leaders of it. And so I think she fits with Plumet in that way. But I think just Plumet is a great outlet for her to be brave and try something new. Do you think that Jude feels differently about the meaning of home at the end of the book?
I think so. I don't know if she fully believes that where she is in Cincinnati is fully home yet, but she has discovered a more metaphorical meaning for the word home that didn't exist for her at the very beginning of the story.
Yeah, and I think home, because I feel like if we went through every character, their definitions of home would be different. Like, I think of her uncle, and it's like where you are right now.
Yeah.
But I think Jude still feels like she has a couple homes, and I think also homes are where these people that she loves, like her Baba and Issa, I think she would also consider them home. But yeah, now this is not just a place, this is not just America, but it has more of that feel, because I think the family connection, and then also feeling the English, and then also feeling connected with people at school and making friends. Movies! Yeah, what do you think about the movies and the talk of America through that before Jude even got there? And why do you think she prefers comedies over other things?
I mean, I would imagine the comedy is just kind of because they're fun, right? I mean, 12, 13-year-old girls are not necessarily going to be into period dramas. Or maybe they will be, I don't know, or Schwarzenegger flicks and things like that. You know, and they're like, and this is, she's growing up in an age where, like, there are a lot of comedies and things exported, and she's looking at Julia Roberts in Notting Hill, which is like, Julia Roberts is like one of the epitome of like an American movie star of her time, right? So yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. This takes me back to a documentary I watched a long time ago called Chuck Norris versus Communism, which was about how people used to smuggle 80s action movies into Romania in the 80s, and like, so there was some sort of inspiration that like they'd all like watch these movies and it became America in some way, but it also kind of had a symbolic value to them and things like that. And I, you know, entertainment is our biggest export as a country, and the idea that we could be represented by these things and people can grow up thinking that on some level this is what America is like, or these are what Americans are, makes total sense to me. And that she would choose something nice like Notting Hill or whatever is pretty cool. And I think it's actually also just shows a little bit of maturity on her part that she's not choosing like Shrek or something animated. Nothing against animation. I don't want the animation stands down my throat about how animation
we're canceled,
blah, blah, blah,
already.
But she's not a kid choosing cartoons, right? She is a little bit older and she's choosing a more adult thing, which is like a rom-com. So
we were two episodes away from 100 and you just had us canceled. How could you? I love this for people of the world, because I think that I read about it. I'm hoping that this, obviously these are fictional tales, but I'm hoping that because they've happened so frequently that it's true. I seem to read about it in like war-torn, totalitarian, a bad like potential living situation areas in the world, that they are just super excited to watch American media, often years behind. Could be like in the 80s or something like that. And I think it's just like a great form of escapism. But I also worry, because I wonder if as they're doing this and kind of getting educated, that they truly believe that is what American culture is. Yeah, I just don't want anyone coming over here and have their heart broken, basically. But I will see, because I was watching, it was like a random clip of Conan O'Brien is like going to different places in the world and is just being like an obnoxious tourist, I think, and learning about things. And I think he went to Ireland and he met somebody who said that her dream is to go to Wisconsin. And so he's like befuddled, quite rightly, and he said, like, why, what is it about Wisconsin? It was
Love Actually,
basically,
right?
is Love Actually in Wisconsin?
No, isn't it a bit like in Wisconsin, in Love Actually, that a couple of the guys, some of the women or somebody want to go to Milwaukee, I believe it
Oh,
is.
golly. I don't
Yeah.
recall.
It's been a
It's
long
been a
time.
little while since I've read it. But yeah, he's just like, why Wisconsin? You know, she liked, I guess, the way that it said. So I just don't know, are people coming up with these ideas and it'll be false. But no, I do love the movies that bring joy to her life. I'm pretty sure that Sarah was watching Pretty Little Liars, and I was thinking, like, why are these seventh graders watching this terrible show?
Here I am, like watching an eighth grade watching It
Oh gosh, yeah. No,
and watching Freddy movies
you're
and
too far
Jason
gone. Yeah,
movies
you're too far gone.
and the amount of nudity I saw on a movie screen
I'm sure.
before I was of legal R-rated movie age is kind of shameful if you think
Yeah.
about it.
So, yeah, I think that she's looking for more uplifting things rather than four friends trying to figure out who killed their fifth abusive friend. Yeah, and it's a good connection, I think, to Issa and Fatima as well, because it brings all of them together. Let's talk about Issa a little bit. How would you describe him, and why do you think, or why is Jude torn between her brother and her father? And will this, do you think it could ever get resolved?
Issa is, the conflict between Issa and his father just comes off to me as like a generational conflict, just like we would have in America if this were like the Vietnam War, right? Where maybe just and again, just kind of like using stereotypical characters from a Vietnam War drama would be the more conservative father and the college student conscientious objector son. And that's kind of the some of the conflict I got between Issa and his father is that his I don't know if his father was a Assad follower. I think it was just he was more protective and more conservative in the sense of not rocking the boat too much. And Issa was, no, I'm going to exercise my right to protest and even be more radical than that. And then Jude, I think, feels stuck in the middle. She's young when she leaves. She's not fully aware of what's going on and doesn't have the context to comprehend the whole thing, right? So if she were leaving, if she were 18 and in the start of this novel, I think it'd probably be a whole different story that she would know a lot more, but her parents have probably been able to shield her to some degree from what's been going on. So the conflict becomes, yeah, it's just she is pulled in several different directions and she sees what's going on between her father and her brother. And but I think eventually it just becomes like they miss each other and they are family, and she is so concerned for him that whatever reservation she had is just brushed aside, especially by the time they finally are able to talk to him.
Yeah, I don't know if he's like an extremist, but I would say that Issa's an activist.
Yeah. I
I
think
think
that's a great word
he's
for it.
educated because he was supposed to go to uni. And yeah, he's just trying to, I think, change the world, change the situation. And so, yeah, I think as a parent, you know, just being scared for your child and for that safety. I don't, yeah, it's hard to know whether it would be, you know, if we were to think about if there was an epilogue or a sequel to this, what this would look like, because I fear that Issa might get killed.
Me too.
He was in an aid camp, I think, when he made that call, but Jude says that he did not promise that he wouldn't go back to Aleppo. So I feel like he's still drawn there, which is just, yeah, ever so dangerous. But yeah, you got to give credit, obviously, for doing what you believe in. Yeah, so I think that's hard. I think there's going to be love, but that conflict probably won't be resolved unless Issa returns home. And then I don't know, like looking into the future, this could be like another question. Is Baba going to come over to America? Is this just what the family situation is now, where they're doing digital calls? And
That's a
would
good
Issa, I don't
question.
know that Issa would ever, if even if he left Aleppo or the hot zones, I don't know that he would ever leave Syria.
No, I get the impression that Issa's going to stay until the job is done.
Yeah.
I don't know about her father, though, and I don't know if it's his choice or not. You know, can he get out of the country if he wanted to?
How
Like,
do
what?
you, in what ways would that be different than the mother?
I don't know. I don't know what the
Okay.
logistically speaking bureaucracy, what has been closed off in terms of emigrating from Syria to the United States in the time that they've been in the United States, and her father wants to come over. Things do change. There is, you know, and again, it's just kind of a, or is her father being on the Syrian end of things being held up, so to speak. Like, you know, there's, I think governmental interference is the best way to think about, like, you know, why her father might not be able to come over, either that or money. So that's where I'm wondering, like, did he make a certain sacrifice to send them there, knowing that he might not be able to make it over there?
Well, here's the thing. Who had the money? I'm wondering if the brother had the money.
Oh, that's a great point. He like sponsored them more or less, right? So I don't know then what the logistics and the bureaucratic ish stuff had to go down. And if he was only allowed to bring them over as opposed to the whole family. That's a good question.
I have some questions about immigration too, because, well, I guess they were able to get in because they knew someone there. But at a certain
Yes.
point, wouldn't officials probably be seeking them out?
What, like INS or ICE or whatever?
Yeah, I don't know. To be sure that they become citizens, because there was no process. The only time we heard about citizenship was via Ben in her
Yeah.
ESL class, and so I wonder when is this going to happen?
Being that they're refugees,
Oh, true.
I think that at least back then would have granted them some sort of special status. I don't know what in this present day or after this present day that we're talking now, what would happen with the refugee status in immigration in the future.
Yeah.
I know that in a number of cases, to come into a country like the United States or Canada or something, you have to have a what's deemed a legitimate reason to move. One being like in some cases, employment. So like, you know, there are tons of like people over here from other countries on work visas, for instance, and stuff like that. So yeah, it's our immigration process is a bureaucratic nightmare.
Of course.
And, you know, just a soapbox for a second. Like, we hear a lot about immigration reform, and certain people just go down the racist angle there without mentioning the fact that it is so labyrinthine,
Labyrinthian?
labyrinthian, thank you, to navigate the immigration process into this country. Becoming a citizen is insanely hard, and that has less to do with the requirements and more to do with the paperwork. You know, like it's just so if you're going to reform immigration, streamline it, make it less of a enormous this enormous beast, you know. make the process better. But like, you know, it's hard to change bureaucracy. And I think that, you know, I see that being an issue in terms of the immigration and such, but I think the refugee status does protect them to a certain extent as well.
Yeah, I love how we put immigrants through a terrible test that most Americans would not pass.
I know.
It's kind of
And
nuts.
we'll elect people to office who barely paid attention in history class in high school, but
Yeah.
let's get
Make
back to the
people blow
topic at
this up.
hand.
Yeah. Should get kicked out of the country if you
Oh my
can't pass the test
God.
then.
It's not hard.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, so finding out that her mother didn't send the letters, what was your reaction to that? Why didn't she send
Oh.
it? Do you think she should have sent the letters?
It wasn't her excuse. Her reason because she doesn't know where Fatima is because Fatima left.
Yes.
And so she can't send the letters there. So it's tough because I get holding on to the letters because she doesn't know where her daughter's friend is. But at the same time, I'm torn on whether or not she made the right decision to not tell Jude sooner. Because on one hand, Jude is going through a lot. I don't want to add to her sadness right now and what her grief, right, over losing home, to tell her that her best friend is missing and unaccount we can't account for her. She might be alive, but we don't know where she is because it would devastate her. But on the other hand, you're lying to your daughter and you're doing it in a way that's like really a violation of her trust, right, in you. And she's like, you're like the only person at that point in time that she feels she can trust. So that's frustrating.
And, you know, to a certain extent, we'll take what the mother says as truth. I
Yeah.
mean, here's hoping that was actually it. Part of me, though, does wonder, and sometimes we like lie to ourselves as well as other people, whether it was a notebook situation. Have you seen The Notebook?
No,
Oh, Tom. Tom, Tom, Tom.
next month the
Okay.
requirement
Well,
of the notebook.
in The Notebook. At Noah writes Allie every day for a year, and she didn't receive any of them, which is why she moves on with her life and gets engaged to somebody else, Cyclops from the X-Men.
He
And
is always the guy.
who never gets the girl?
He's always the
Yeah. Well,
guy.
he got the girl, Jean Grey, and he was in another Nicholas Sparks movie, and he gets the girl, but then he gets
Okay.
killed. But anyways, yeah, so it just reminds me of that. Was it a way for her mother to hasten the process of feeling like America is home?
Yeah, that's a
Maybe
good point.
subconsciously.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. The Notebook's
Interesting.
Rachel McAdams, right?
That is correct. And Ryan Gosling?
Mm.
Wow, you should make you could it could be a date night movie.
I don't think I could stomach it as much as I would love to make out with Rachel McAdams.
She's not on your card. You're not allowed.
She, the family stone, she is like so
Oh, the
damn. Like
family
she's giving
stone.
like Winona Ryder, and
Oh,
that's like
wow.
really, really hot. Okay,
Oh
anyway.
my gosh, we've lost it. Friends, I'm so sorry that this show is going to end at episode 98. You don't even get to hear what 100 was going to be, but you blame Tom.
All right. Back to
Anything else?
lying
Yeah, I know.
parents.
Chapter 9 in part 5, page 260 in particular, that Layla rushes over to her is on Valentine's Day. Jude thought maybe she would hear some scandalous gossip, but and then she tells me about the explosion, about the blood in the streets, and the horror and the death. I am upset and sad about what she tells me, but confused why she is so fixated on this news when it happened in a city so far away from us. Be careful, Jude, she says, and I don't understand. She tells me that now I will learn what it means to be a Muslim in America. Anything? So it could just be
I don't think
any attack.
there was one in Manila in the Philippines in 2005. The only bombing that happens in 2013 would be the Boston Marathon, but that's in April. So I think the author just made it up.
Yeah.
Just to give that, because just because it's like, okay, what is it like to be of Middle Eastern nationality, whether you're Arabic, Syrian, Iranian, Iraqi, what have you, and have a Muslim terrorist. Well, you know what? Any terrorist attack in the country that involves a bomb, because I distinctly, so the first person I ever met of Syrian descent was a young woman I had class with back in college, Rana, and she was actually Catholic, so she wasn't Muslim. but she was of Syrian descent, and she wrote an essay. It was like for our freshman comp class or something, and it got published in one of the lit mags at my college. And it was called "Waking Up to the Bomb," and this was 1996, so it was about the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing and how, in the very immediate aftermath of the bombing, before anybody knew who Timothy McVeigh was, blame was pushed toward Muslim terrorists. And so she was just like, I think one of the first lines of the essay was something along the lines like, holy, please don't let it be the Arabs or something like that. In other words, like, you know, the idea that even back like 30 years ago, the stereotype of the Muslim person was the terrorist, right? So I think that's what she's putting in the novel here, and that's what she's getting at, where it's like, you know, you're kind of naive at this point as being new to this country, mm-hmm. and you've been pretty lucky
yeah
so far, but now you're gonna know what it's really like, and that's ominous and it's sad, but I think that it's one of the fears that they do live with, you know, in the same way. And, you know, it's equated, there's stereotypes about black and brown people in this country that they have to deal with and live with and be afraid of being treated a certain way because of, you know, presupposed assumptions about what they do as a culture or something. So the idea that this would happen, and then I think it was a way for her to bring it into the story and have it have more of an impact rather than just have like random racist white boy be racist.
Right.
You know?
Yep. Yeah. Do you think it would have been as strong had 9/11 not happened? Because don't you think that's like where everything kind of began with Islamophobia?
Oh, no. Oh. Islamophobia begins in 1979. I mean, prior to 1979.
Okay.
With the Iranian hostage crisis.
I see.
Yeah. Like the Ayatollah through the 80s. And but even prior to that, you have the PLO, and you have the Munich, the killing of Israeli athletes in Munich prior to the 72 Olympics. You have the association of Muslims with terrorism goes back like 50, 60 years. But no, like the current kind of iteration, in fact, 9/11 on some level goes back to 1979 between the Iranian hostage crisis and the Soviets' invasion of Afghanistan. And, you know, and prior to 9/11, and maybe it's because I was, you know, I'm from Long Island. So knowing the number of ways in which number of plots that Osama bin Laden supposedly had and how airport security really was ramped up like crazy in like 97, 98 based on different threats, and they couldn't find bin Laden and like all this other stuff. It didn't come out of like left field. It certainly amplified the Islamophobia, especially as you got into the Iraq War. You know, it made it much, much worse. And I think that it would still be there. I think what this does, though, is gives it a little – by putting this bombing in there, it gives some of the events that happened afterward a little bit more of a context, because the vandalism to the restaurant still could have happened, but there was nothing to suggest that it was going to happen. And all of a sudden you have this, and it's like, oh – yeah, now the racist got turned on. And, you know, so certainly somebody could have been like that, but there was nothing like, there was no pre-spoken tension about the neighborhood or whatever prior to the bombing happened. So, but yeah. Anyway.
I feel like the first time I thought everything will be okay, this is nice. And then the second time I was dreading it, I was like, oh no, I know when it happens.
Yeah.
And it's so sad because even, you know, no one, she smiles at so many people. And then she says when she wore her headscarf, now people like were noticing her. Mm-hmm. So it's already like, I don't know, like a yellow flag of some sort was being raised.
Yeah.
And then to go after a child, like that man. A man going after a child. Police.
Well,
like it's already bad enough going after anyone, but you know, a 12-year-old girl and saying go back home is just nuts. I don't know.
it is nuts, but at the same time, there's how many Karen videos do we have of that happening on some level, or something racist crap being leveled at a couple of black kids who were dared to play at a park, or, you know, whatever. I mean, it's all over. So that was a realistic moment.
Yeah. And then having the vandalism on Alibaba, but it creates a wonderful moment, which I said the baby was the connecting factor, but I think that fundraiser also really brought Sarah back into the fold, because I think that was when she apologized for being mean about Layla.
Yeah.
So that was like a beautiful moment that came out of tragedy and a community coming together, which I thought was really nice.
Yeah.
I think a character we didn't really talk about was Miles. What do you think about this guy? Do you ship Miles and Jude?
He's the kid with the galaxy shirt, right? It was kind of cute. He's kind of a nerdy, dorky kid. Have you ever seen the movie Eighth Grade?
I have.
You know the kid at the end, like the very end, he like that weird nerd kid she has like kind of the date with at the end, who's like has to have chicken nuggets or something in her house? That's who I thought of. Like this kind of like quirky, weird guy, and she kind of like likes him, and yeah, so that's the scene that came to mind at the very end of Eighth Grade, where she's like hanging out with the like really, really dorky kid, and it's like really cute. Yeah, I thought it was very, very cute. And on some level, I guess I shipped them, but not in a like really hot and steamy Stella smut sort of way.
Oh no, no, no. That will come later when they're in high school. No, but I can kind of foresee them maybe dating later on. I mean, they're only in seventh grade, but yeah, friends, yeah. And something else. But I like how he was seated kind of from the very beginning when she first went to school. And then she had like admiration and curiosity about this guy who wore these space shirts and could talk about math well.
Yeah.
And then finally them becoming friends, and then him rushing after that creepy old man accosts her, and finding out that they live near each other, and him being the first person she opens up to about Issa, like all these really wonderful things. So I feel like Miles is because I see a question I have is, how is Layla a good friend? Which I would consider her, but I think she also has some failings, whereas Miles I feel like is a really good friend. He was just so kind and empathetic, and sometimes it takes like an outsider to, you know, be with another outsider and best understand them, but I just think that he's a great guy, so I innocently ship them. Do you think that Jude's brave?
I think so, because she could have very well not tried. And she could have very well been, just could have gone down a darker road, a more depressing road. She could have crawled into herself, and that's not who she is. And it took a while because she had to navigate this new place. But I feel that by the end of the novel, she feels that she has really found something about herself there. And that took a fair amount of courage.
Yeah. Yeah, she's so brave. You know, she went over there. She's like, I've got to be brave for Issa and Baba and my mother and my little sister. And I feel like she definitely does it. And she's the point person. I've seen this a lot where children will often be the English speaker for a parent. Saw that at Michael's, you know, saw that at school and outside of school and everything. And she is, like, when the immigration officer is talking to her, she will be the person to talk back to them in English and translate for her mother. She's there at the doctor's office, both out of love and also, I think, to translate. Yeah, and then you're right, yeah, the fact that she is trying and she is learning about the culture, learning the language, and trying to make friends. And also, I think her maybe the bravest act is auditioning and stepping out on stage. So good on you, Jude.
Yeah.
Do you believe that this book provides a window, mirror, or sliding glass door?
Yes, to all three. For me, it's certainly a window, right?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I've had, like I said, I teach freshmen, and I have some freshmen who are very much like Jude. So it actually is a good window for me into maybe a little bit of what they've been through if they've come over in the country the last few years, things like that. So, but I mean, somebody who is Muslim or is just an immigrant too. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be a Syrian immigrant. It could be somebody from like El Salvador or something, and they might see a mirror or a sliding glass door here.
Yes. Yeah, 100%. I think all of the above. Yeah, I think a window for me as well as a sliding glass door. Sliding glass door more so, I think, for the ESL community. I feel like I don't know many Arab people. I know some Muslim people, but it's hard to like then, you don't go up to them and be like, excuse me, tell me about your origin. But yes, yeah, definitely window. And then mirror to a certain extent of the teachers. You know, and figuring out how can we as educators, you know, be welcoming and consider students that might have this type of background.
Good point.
Yeah. Thank you, Tom. And Tom, what is this required reading?
I think that this is something you really could assign to like 6th, 7th graders because there's something really rewarding about it. So for that particular audience, I think the answer is very close to yes. For an older audience like high school or you know us or something, it's somebody brought it to me and said this is any good. I definitely recommend it.
Yes. I feel like this could be a good classroom novel to discuss. Mm-hmm. I know that it's middle grade, but I think benefits could be seen in middle school as well as maybe lower high school. Because I'm sure once you get up to 11th or 12th, they might feel offended that you're giving them that.
Yeah, it's not the subject matter. It's the ease. Lexile level is completely disproven these days. But the idea of the reading level of the book.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, but I think if we are trying to, which I think it, obviously, you know, people like Miles Robert are trying to prevent this. But if we're trying to make our classrooms multicultural and having different voices, I think that this is something that should be included. So I'm going to say yes. And I think that, yeah, hope people, just for funsies, should also read it because I think that you'll fall in love with you just like I did.
Yep.
Okay. Hey, Tom, you did not put any questions.
I did not. And I have pulled up a couple of Facebook comments on the last. I didn't drop any feedback in there. But I did pull up the Facebook comments from the last episode, and I know that you are doing Dear Reader for the Iliad, yeah. So I think you'll probably get more comments on that than you would for this the Iliad episode. First, Robert Ward, our Scholastic Book Buddy, said that I don't think, regarding a Batgirl novel, he says, I don't think Batgirl is in the Batman Resurrection novel since it's a sequel to the 89 film, but they did just release a new Batgirl novel called Batgirl Possession. So I can't remember what context that was in. Gene.
Because there was a new Batman novel out and you said you were going to read it and you asked if I was, and I was like, oh, you know, I've got other things. If Batgirl were in it, sure, but other things take priority on my TBR. Yeah.
Admittedly, a little lower on my TBR because of other stuff I'm reading, so. I don't even have it yet, so I might check it out if the library gets it. Let's see. Gene Hendricks commented regarding, he said he was going to wait for save the vast majority of his comments on the Iliad for Dear Reader, but he had to wait what moment he needed to address. This has to do with me saying that, he says, Tom, in what way? And this is where I step in it because it's like, oh crap, I said something about Arthurian legend. And Gene's like really, really good at Arthurian legend stuff. I'm a rank amateur, even though I've got plenty of stuff I'm intending to read. Anyway, Tom, in what way is Arthur and Mordred killing each other? Arthur making up for anything? Keep in mind that for almost half of all of Mordred's life, the only person who knew Mordred's real father was actually Morgause, his sister and Mordred's mother. This guy should be a podcast episode of its own. Yeah. I have to go reread the Arthurian legend. I think I might've been doing it in the context of your past sins coming back to haunt you or your past deeds coming back to haunt you, which is, you know, a classic literary trope, but I will defer to Gene on that, and we'll put a pin in that, and eventually myself get around to reading more and more and more of the Arthurian legend. He did loan me or give me a copy of a PDF of a role-playing game manual for Pendragon, which is a King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table Arthurian legend role-playing game. And I've been reading through it because it goes year by year through first the reign of Uther Pendragon and then his son Arthur. It's fascinating. I haven't gotten to any of the really, really big stuff yet, but it's really fascinating. So anyway,
Tom, how foolish, foolish that you would say something. That's like how you beat me down. I said, hey, didn't Islamophobia come about after 9/11? You're like, no. So it was the same thing, except you were right there with me. That's probably what Gene did.
I have learned my lesson. So this really is the last episode of this.
It really is. It was nice to hear from you. How many years? 6, 7?
Yeah. It's nice knowing you.
Yeah.
No, we got at least one more because we got to get to what I'm picking, right?
Yes. I guess to make it even, Steven. But I already am disgusted because isn't it Valentine's Day?
Yes, but let's keep in mind.
Okay.
Let's keep in mind that March will be episode 100.
Okay.
And then you will get 101, which will be April. And for the rest of the year, you have the even months. Okay. So you will have October and December of 2025.
Finally, for the first time ever.
Yes. Not for the first time ever, but you will have October and December of 2025. So, yeah. So I guess you would like to know what we're reading.
Yeah, so, I'm interested to hear what we're doing. Is it going to be some smut?
No. It's episode 99, so we're going to do a biography of Wayne Gretzky. No, I'm not. I'm kidding. I was thinking romance, and I'm like, oh. And I honestly went through 5 different picks, like everything from like Shakespeare to like the Bridges of Madison County. I was trying to find something that would be like a really cool kind of like, this is a popular, well-known love story. And I went with something that is a classic love story that has been done and redone. The concept of which has been done and redone over and over and over.
Is it Afraid of Virginia Woolf? No, what was I thinking? Wait, that is what it's called, isn't it?
Yeah, no.
The play?
Yeah, the play. It is a play. It is a very old French play. We're going to talk about Cyrano de Bergerac.
Wow. In the original French?
Yes. Let me conjure up 2 semesters of French that I took 30 years ago and maybe 2 or 3 years of high school and be fluently reading it. No.
I believe in us.
Oui. So, yes. So come back 30 days for Cyrano de Bergerac. And until then, as always, we are on the various socials. The Twitter feed is not as active as it has been. I've more or less abandoned Twitter. I still have 2-3 accounts or so, but I really haven't done anything. And I'm over at Blue Sky at using my pop culture affidavit.
Okay.
I think I'm PopAff over there. Let me open up. Yes, I'm PopAff.BlueSky.social. So if you want to follow me over there, you can. And then I do post about – we do still post on Facebook. You can leave comments there. Pop culture affidavit, my other podcast. I do post screenshots and – for this particular show as well when the episodes come out, so you're always welcome. And of course we have our email address. You can email us there, so do that. And as always, thanks for listening and take care,
and consider if you take your steak rare, medium rare, or well done.
Medium rare.
So you got some blood.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
rare's hard. Rare's too much for me. And well done, no.
Well done for me. Nope. Well, I don't even eat steak. I don't even know what I'm saying. Yeah, I don't even eat cow. Okay. Yeah. But no, there'd be no blood. That'd be gross. So.
Good night.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by 2 True Freaks. That's 2 True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreading with Tom and Stella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.